is Cascadia Public Radio.
So, a consistent message is becoming clear. We are all free-willed, multidimensional beings composed of both the physical and the spiritual. Our individual bodies are made up of physical matter that must conform to physical law. But our bodies are energized by a thinking form of energy, the soul, if you prefer, which, like all energy, can neither be created nor destroyed, only change form. Many researchers into our spiritual side believe that mankind is in the process of shifting into a higher plane of existence, one that deals from the heart, not the intellect. Our multidimensional side has blocked conscious memory of our true nature because of the lessons to be learned during our physical existence on Earth. At the level of this sentient and creative energy, we are all, humans as well as all other life forms in the universe, connected in some type of comprehensive energy grid, akin to Einstein's unified field theory. This appears to operate at the submolecular level or beyond, which our science is only just now discovering. Quantum physics is what he's talking about there. It is at this level that man's intuitive and psychic abilities come into play. The alien agenda obviously encompasses much more than one race seeking to enslave or exploit the Earth. Considering all accounts, there are many different races visiting us today, apparently for many different reasons, some benign and helpful, others perhaps more selfish. Whatever the motivations and whatever the technology in use, this agenda involves all concerned, human and otherwise, and it involves the prime creative force in the universe, the creator of all. As abductee Julie Doherty was told by a alien gray when she asked about God, the response was, "He's the same to us as he is to you." That's interesting. So it would appear that religion, or more specifically, spiritualism, is interconnected with the alien agenda. While most religions address facets of spiritual truth, none can claim exclusive knowledge. The world's religions can be compared to the story of the blind man and the elephant. They all have a piece of the truth, but their interpretations may not be on the mark. Today, many feel that organized religion is about the control of understanding. It is the mind of man trying to interpret the heart of God and not doing a very good job of it. It has been said that every human feeling originates from only two basic emotions, love and fear. Love, the basis of compassion, sympathy, and understanding, stems from man's highest energy level, while fear, the product of intolerance, hatred, and violence, comes from our basest energy level. Love, said to flow from God, is of the heart. Fear is a product of the mind. Unfortunately, too many religions focus on fear. Fear of Satan, fear of death, and fear of the afterlife to control members. All of humanity may be moving into a higher consciousness. Some call it Christ consciousness. There is no question that the old order, the old systems, the old ways of doing things is crumbling. New dimensions, new realities are on the horizon, and each of us has a role to play. Mankind is only as strong as its weakest link. There are no victims or castaways. Everyone is involved. Each of us is like a tuning fork. When one resonates with the higher frequency of heartfelt love and understanding, others follow. Many feel that the aliens of energy and light, called the transcendentals by the remote viewers, now that's opposed to the term grays, which are your typical, when you think of an ET, that, you know, we all pretty much have the same image. Those are the grays, and the energy and light beings are the transcendentals. So there you go. Are here to witness and perhaps help our shift to new realities. It is literally a rebirth, and like any birth, there will be pain as we all move through the physical transitions. Fear will only make it worse. Yet fear will continue to be a large part of our experience until we are able to break through the government secrecy and media-driven illusion of life to gain a full knowledge of our world, of our history, our future, and our relationship with others in the universe. The advent of the UFO phenomenon on our collective consciousness in recent years may well be a wake-up call, a not-so-subtle message that human intellectual knowledge is not the end-all of existence, or any assurance of peace and tranquility. I think it's pretty clear that, leave it to humankind, we're not doing too well in any area, that's for sure. It won't be proven with a slide rule, nor seen in a telescope, for true love and understanding, the basis for everything good and desirable, we must look inward. We all know truth when we hear it. It resonates deep within an individual being. We will know it by the subtle signs from the heart. And last paragraph here. Mankind, in its present growth phase, might be compared to the college student, who, as a freshman, believes she knows everything, but as a senior, realizes she knows very little. How true is that? I know so much less now than I did when I started this whole crazy journey. Our adolescence is coming to an end, and it is time to break free from all dogmatic authority figures and begin to take our rightful place as free-thinking and responsible members of a universal public. After all, to anyone not from Earth, we are the aliens, and fearsome ones at that, with our primitive and destructive ways. Perhaps we are the focus of universal concern and are all being guided by a host of non-human life forms. So there we are. Now, of course, there is no smoking gun. I think that crop circles comes fairly close. I also think the interest by the military and the American government in particular shows that, you know, there's something a lot more going on, you know, especially when they claim, go away, go back to sleep, everything's fine here. So that, to me, is two really strong cases that there's a lot more to it than most of us know. Okay, so there we are. That's a look at Jim Mars and David Icke prior to that. And we're going to move on now. I have another audio piece. This comes from a documentary called Star Dreams, Exploring the Mystery of Crop Circles. It was published in 2005. The writer and director is Robert L. Nickel. I've got a 3-minute clip from that. And when we return, I'm going to take a look at specifically crop circles. So let's move on to this clip from the documentary Star Dreams, Exploring the Mystery of Crop Circles. We'll be back shortly after that. Let me remind you that we are listening to CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo, Radio Malaspina. We are also online. You can listen to us online from anywhere that the web takes you, and that is at www.chly.ca.
The Hopi prophecies speak of this time when we have a choice of either choosing the path of extreme purification or a gentler path. One of the terms that has been used through the Hopi prophecy is the emergence of the fifth world of peace. And literally, the Hopis have told us that we are transcending from the third to the fifth dimension. And a Hopi elder has recently said, "We are the ones we've been waiting for."
And I think that's where we are with the crop circles. They are here to change us from the inside. They're not coming here to change things for us. It'll be too easy to do this if God opens you a new line of credit and, you know, we wipe up all the bad things we've done. It's not like that at all. You know, as the Hopis say, you know, we're the people we've been waiting for. And if we can change ourselves through the interaction with these wonderful temples, then that is the ultimate message, because we change everything around us, we change the world with us, and by doing so, we actually acknowledge prophecy from every part of the world.
There is a really good possibility that the crop circles are teaching us a way by showing us of making those manipulations to our environment so that we can evolve.
Suddenly it's offered on a plate, it's dropped from the sky every night in the summer here. And when we look at these, it is universal knowledge that's been conveyed there. So if we have an invitation to raise our understanding to a more universal level. Now that's evolution.
They are, if you like, playthings scattered on the nursery carpet to train us to play with the big boys.
Ancient prophecies speak of the return of an ascended civilization on Earth. A return to oneness. The great gift of the crop circles, really, is to help us awaken to our divine potential and the realization that oneness of being is our true state. They represent an emerging sacred reality, the coming of a new level of consciousness, one of light, of spirit, of new design.
Okay, there we are. So that is a clip from the film Star Dreams, Exploring the Mystery of Crop Circles. And I'm going to move now to looking at a book. It's not about crop circles, but it is covered in one of the chapters. And the book is 2012, The Return of Quetzalcoatl, who's a Mayan deity. I'm not positive about the enunciation. It's Quetzal, C-O-A-T-L. And I have a feeling that maybe that T, maybe that L is silent. But anyways, the author is Daniel Pinchbeck. And what can I tell you a little bit about the back of the book? Is saying that he has written for New York Times Magazine, Esquire, Wired, The Village Voice, LA Weekly, Art Forum, author, and many other publications. He is currently a national columnist for Conscious Choice Magazine and the editor-director of RealitySandwich.com. He lives in New York. Now, the book is... Well, boy, about a lot of things. It was an interesting read, and what I'm going to use from it is his discussion on crop circles, and I'm going to be skipping around a bit. I've pulled out my favorite choice pieces to present to you, but let's start at the beginning of chapter 2. Through the internet, I discovered the crop circles, which are geometric patterns appearing in agricultural lands across the world, in Europe, Eastern Europe, the United States, and South America, although especially concentrated in the UK. Like most people, I had assumed they were junk, a long-running hoax designed to fool the gullible community of UFO fans and New Agers, grist for late-night exposés on trashy cable TV shows. The crop formations had developed into a far more extravagant, even awesome, phenomenon than I imagined. I spent many hours reading geometrical and biophysical studies of the formations, testimonies by hoaxers, extraterrestrial hypotheses, and personal accounts of the patterns, and by studying pictures of them. So the first place I'm going to go is, let's take a look at the hoaxers, and this is pretty amazing. Two people came forward and said, we did it. And the media said, case closed, they did it. But there's a lot more to it than that, isn't there? But let's hear about this hoaxers here. 1991 was also the year that hoaxers made their mark on the phenomenon, permanently tweaking it by introducing an unavoidable and perhaps necessary element of duplicity and confusion. Two laborers in their 60s, they're not young kids, Doug Bauer and Dave Corley, stepped forward to take credit for the crop circles. In front of the world's media, they gave a reenactment of their circle-making methods, which the press found satisfactory. But some researchers found crude and imprecise. They showed headgear made of bent wires, which they said helped them make straight lines in total darkness. They said they had created hundreds of hoaxed patterns over two decades, though none around Avebury, the epicenter of the phenomenon. And they offered no explanation for the hundreds of other formations that had appeared. Satisfied with this debunking, the reporters decamped. So there we are. It was solved. It was two old guys that, you know, were making a couple a night. I mean, you know, it's physically impossible, of course. However, let's move on and look at, I guess, an intellectual look, an intellectual profile of the unknown crop circle. The circle makers was raised considerably by Gerald Hawkins, who is the former chair of the astronomy department at Boston University and the author of Stonehenge Decoded. So in that book, Stonehenge Decoded, Hawkins had applied rigorous astronomical and geometrical analyses to explore how Stonehenge functioned as an observatory and calculator for predicting lunar eclipses. Among other facts, he discovered a Neolithic knowledge of the precise coordination of the Earth's orbit and lunar and solar cycles that modern astronomy had not yet obtained. And what he discovered is that the Sun and Moon return to the same stellar alignment in relationship to the Earth every 56 years. Stonehenge apparently told him that. So he used the same techniques to study the geometry of the crop formations. He realized that the particular ratios he was finding again and again in ringed circles and in the smaller satellite circles fit the series of diatonic ratios, the intervals of the musical scale. Quote, "A ratio in the diatonic scale is the step up in pitch from one note to the other. The creators seemed to know of these fractions, taking care to encode them in the shapes so they could be retrieved by someone studying aerial photographs," he wrote. Even in similarly simple functions, the circle makers had encoded, for those who might be curious, a mastery of geometry and an interest in harmonic pitch. Yeah, interesting, eh? To make them, you know, some of them are, you know, more than 100 yards wide. I mean, they're monstrous, you know, and absolutely perfect, you know, when seen through an aerial photograph. Okay, so let's return to the idea of media here. And Daniel Pinchbeck says, in our society, the media functions as a collective nervous system or immune response task force, inoculating the social body against any new pattern or incoming information that might threaten conventional values and biases. The Doug and Dave story of inventing the crop circles was accepted at face value and not interrogated by the media. Their claims had the effect of discrediting the phenomenon in the eyes of the world. Doug and Dave and other hoaxers that followed them provided a convenient excuse for ignoring and ridiculing the formations without giving them careful attention. During the 1990s, the formations in the fields continued to evolve. This took place in relative quiet. Much of the media coverage and popular attention dispersed after the phenomenon was officially labeled a fraud. However, those who continued to follow the patterns were treated to ever more elaborate and extraordinary configurations, using increasingly complex geometry. Southern England receives anywhere from a few dozen to 100 configurations a year, some obvious human-made attempts, but many spectacular formations featuring 7-, 8-, and 9-fold geometry, Mobius strips, toroids, DNA spirals, sunflower burst, precise astronomical configurations revealing certain dates, pictograms, electromagnetic fields, futuristic variations of the yin-yang symbol, and various complex fractals. So the crop circles are becoming more complex as the time goes on, and the language, they've upped the ante. And now we're going to look now at a researcher here, and that will conclude our look at crop circles. And Michael Glickman is the researcher of crop circles that Daniel Pinchbeck is going to be talking about, and he was also in the audio clip that I played from that movie, Star Dreams. And he was my favorite speaker from that film, so it's kind of neat that Daniel includes him as well. He says, the researcher who most impressed me, who inspired me to pursue the phenomenon in depth, was Michael Glickman, an English architect and industrial designer who had retired to Wiltshire to study the circles more than a decade earlier. On the phone, Glickman did not hedge his bets. He was feisty and funny, at times exasperated. I am an architect, he said. As an architect, one is interested in form, design, geometry. I worked in product development. I know about factory processes and mechanical developments. When I started to look into the crop circles in the late 1980s, it was immediately, screamingly apparent that to me, no human technology, no human methods could manifest the formations. Glickman called the glyphs a series of profound, diverse, and complex communications of a subtle, of a substantial lightness and subtlety. They are using shape and geometry, number and form, to access fundamental parts of our being which have become culturally deactivated over centuries. Again, we can say we're talking about systems here, that the system that we're stuck in right now has purposefully, deactivated us from who we were and you know, are still are just buried in, I guess. So, part of the program is reactivation. That is separate from whatever hard information the circles might be bringing, said Glickman. He believed the formations were linked to an accelerated transformation of human consciousness, pointing to our dimensional shift from the third to what he called the fifth dimension. Glickman thought the patterns clearly the results of a prodigious intelligence, will, and intent, indicated that other forms or levels of galactic intelligence were monitoring the evolution of consciousness on Earth. I'll repeat that. This is what the conclusion Glickman has come to, is that some form or another of galactic intelligence were monitoring the evolution of consciousness on Earth. So, we are being approached after a standoff of millennia. What is approaching us is a federation of non-terrestrial civilizations. As signals, the patterns were coordinated with our ongoing mind shift, providing clues as well as lessons into the new fifth-dimensional form of consciousness we are now approaching. And that, I guess, takes us to the title of the book, 2012, you know, which is suggested by many researchers, and again, these ancient, not philosophy, what's the word I'm looking for? Anyways, that our consciousness is could shift. You know, the fear mongers say, "Oh, it's the end of life, and it's all terrible, terrible." But that is not the case. I don't believe that that is what the prophecies. That's the word I was looking for. That is not what the prophecies speak of. It's a consciousness shift. So there we are. That is a look at crop circles. Actually, I have one more piece concerning crop circles. And this audio clip was created by Beata Van Berkom, and that's the woman in Saskatoon that I had on. If you want to visit my website, it's show number 105, January 21st. Beata was a lot of fun. She was on first as a 9/11 truth activist, and then secondly, the second time as a crop circle researcher. But it was a lot of fun, fun lady. I think you'll like her personality. So, however, she's put out a CD of different spoken word pieces, and she's playing with the theme here that the crop circles are really like a phone call, and why aren't we picking up the phone and saying, hello, who's there? So that's what we're going to listen to, and then when we come back, we're going to have a campus community update that will be followed. And time is working out quite nicely for us tonight. I'm going to play a longer audio piece to conclude the show, and that's the one that the Iraq veteran Anthony Arnov, speaking at a conference put on by Iraq Veterans Against the War, and that will be the final piece. So let's move on to this crop circle phone call and then the campus community updates. So we'll see you folks shortly. Hang in there.
Okay, the phone's been ringing for 30 years now, and we were, and maybe we still are, busy once really ringing, arguing amongst ourselves, unable to agree whether we could verify the fact that there was indeed a telephone in the area, and if in fact it was capable of producing the ringing sound we think we may have heard. After all, it could be a hoax. In fact, we know of a few prank phone callers. In fact, we've been victims of their tricks before. How many times have we scrambled to a ringing phone only to have the caller hang up on us just as we commit to communication? Fear of ridicule and rejection plays a big part in our unwillingness to progress on some issues. But we forge ahead. We next move to looking at what exactly inside the phone produces its ringing noise, how the mechanics of it work. After we have established the ringing telephone and accepted it as part of our reality, and that it is indeed making a sound, using a power source and a mechanism we think we understand, so we feel comfortable, now we feel okay. Will this situation provide enough comfort to allow us room for the idea that this device may also be used in a practical sense as a communication device? Would that lead us to picking up the handle and saying, hello?
Okay, friends, that is going to do it for the campus community update. And it is brought to us by all, again, as always, by the three Canadian 9/11 truth groups that are supporting CHLY and this radio show. They are Edmonton 9/11 Truth, Victoria 9/11 Truth, and Fraser Valley 9/11 Truth. And I'm quite sure that all three of those sponsors, that it runs out at this next fun drive, which is coming up in three episodes. April 22nd is going to be mine. And Doug Brinkman in Edmonton has already pledged for the following year. So that's $150 coming from Edmonton 9/11 Truth. So thank you very much, and I hope that I have lots more truth communities that are going to help keep CHLY on the air. And I can mention your name every time, every week. So that's pretty cool. Okay, time-wise, it is 9:35. Of course, you're listening to CHLY. I'm going to give you my web address one more time because I do archive these shows if you missed one and would like to check it out, or visit the links to the things that I have been talking about. There'll be links for further investigation for you to do. A lot of YouTube clips. I'm a visual learner, and so that certainly helps me out. So let's go now to the final piece I'm going to play for you tonight. And it is an Iraqi veteran, Anthony Arnov, and he's speaking at a conference that was put on by Iraq Veterans Against the War. The conference was called Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan, Eyewitness accounts of the occupation. This is quite a smart piece. I think you're going to enjoy it. Thanks again to Terry for pointing this one out to me. So there we are. I will come back in 20 minutes to say goodnight to you guys. So there we are. Here it is, Anthony Arnov.
It's a real privilege to speak here tonight alongside the courageous members of Iraq Veterans Against the War and alongside others who are committed to telling the truth about the illegal and unjust occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan and who are working to end those occupations. I would like to make five basic points about the two occupations, and then I'd like to draw five broader conclusions about the geopolitical considerations that I see driving U.S. policy. First, it's important to remind ourselves that the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan were launched on false pretenses, and also to underscore that they continue on false pretenses. The Bush administration attacked Iraq, claiming it was preempting the threat posed by Iraq's weapons of mass destruction and its connections to al-Qaeda. Today, we know the full extent of manipulation of intelligence that was used to start a war that was offensive, not defensive, in nature. In Afghanistan, Washington claimed to be carefully targeting terrorists who had attacked the United States, but instead targeted the civilian population of Afghanistan in an open form of collective punishment, which is banned under international law. The war's planners consciously sought to make the general population of Afghanistan suffer, hoping that would help bring down the Taliban regime and also to make an example of Afghanistan. And I think the organizers of this weekend's gathering should be commended that the banner behind us reads Iraq and Afghanistan, because all too often Afghanistan has become the forgotten occupation. Or worse, it has somehow become the good occupation to which we can contrast Iraq. And it's very important that IVAW is bringing the issue of Afghanistan into the discussion, not only because of how it's affecting the people of Afghanistan, but because so many of the soldiers, the troops that have fought in Iraq, also have had field experience in Afghanistan, and also so many of the people that you meet organizing among GIs, among veterans, have had their primary military experience in Afghanistan. They opposed the occupation there, and we have to find a way of involving them in our work connecting these two vital issues. Second, the United States is not stemming, but is in fact fueling sectarian and civil conflict in both countries. In Afghanistan and Iraq, Washington has armed militias that are involved in attacks on civilians, using alliances with the United States to gain money and weapons, and also to call in airstrikes and ground attacks to settle political and sectarian scores. In Afghanistan, as the analyst Stephen Zunis notes, the United States subcontracted security of much of the country to warlords who have actually served to destabilize the country. The United States has used classic colonial divide and rule tactics in both countries for the same reason that all occupations of necessity must: to control and impose the occupier's will upon a population that will not consent to its subjugation. This means the violence we have seen, the torture and homicides at Bagram and Abu Ghraib and beyond, are the logical result, are in fact the inevitable outcome of U.S. policy at the highest levels. The violence does not have its origin in the ideas of the troops or a few bad apples, but emanates from the political leadership and policy set at the top of the chain of command, and from the systematic violence and racism of both occupations. And as we've heard in testimony today, they stem from rules of engagement that guarantee civilians will be degraded, dehumanized, tortured, and killed. Third, The U.S. is not confronting terrorism by staying in Iraq or Afghanistan, as we're often told. The main enemy that the U.S. is confronting in both countries is not al-Qaeda, but the very people we claim to have liberated. As Army Captain Dan Kearney told the New York Times Magazine, speaking about the occupation of Afghanistan, the only reason anyone's listening to me is because I'm dropping bombs on them. In Iraq, poll after poll, including polling done by the U.S. government itself through the State Department and other agencies it's employed, has found that the Iraqis say that they want an end to the occupation, that they view us as occupiers, not as liberators, that they feel less safe, not more safe, as a result of our presence, and they see us as the main source of instability and the main source of sectarian conflict in their country. And let's be clear, this is not a question of mismanagement, of bad planning, or of lack of planning, or an error in this or that counterinsurgency strategy. Is it a political fundamental reality of the occupation? As long as we remain, we will be the source of the instability and the violence. Fourth, the United States is not honoring those who died in Iraq and Afghanistan by continuing the occupations, as President Bush claims. Now more than 4,400 U.S. troops have died in Iraq and Afghanistan. In addition, though this number is rarely mentioned, more than 1,000 private contractors have been killed alongside U.S. forces, as well as scores of journalists, not to mention the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis dead. More than 29,000 U.S. troops have been wounded, many severely. Rates of post-traumatic stress disorder among Iraq and Afghanistan veterans have skyrocketed, as have suicide rates, among many other problems that people have discussed and given personal testimony about in this hearing. Each additional death and injury only compounds the senseless tragedy we have seen so far. Fifth, the United States is not rebuilding or bringing democracy to either country. Despite the billions of dollars Congress has allocated for reconstruction efforts, electricity and access to safe drinking water are below pre-invasion levels in Iraq. Unemployment has skyrocketed as a result of conscious policy decisions taken by the occupation authorities. Inflation is spiraling, again, as a result of conscious economic decisions made by the occupation, putting basic necessities out of reach of most Iraqis. Hospitals are in shambles. And Iraq today has the world's largest and fastest-growing refugee crisis, with more than 2.2 million internally displaced and more than 2.2 million externally displaced Iraqis. Child malnutrition in Iraq has grown worse. The UN, the United Nations, reports that 1 in 4 Iraqi children under 5 now suffers chronic malnourishment. And more than 4 million Iraqis are in need of food assistance. But the country's food ration program is being eliminated as part of the neoliberal reconstruction of Iraq under the direction of the U.S. occupation. In Afghanistan, only 6% of the population has electricity at any point in the day, according to the Asian Development Bank. And ActionAid International estimates that only 14% of U.S. aid to Afghanistan has reached legitimate development projects. Now, women's oppression in Afghanistan, which we should remember was cited by many proponents of the invasion of Afghanistan as a reason why this was a humanitarian, why this was a just war, is as bad and in some cases worse than before the invasion. The Independent newspaper in London recently reported that, quote, grinding poverty and the escalating war is driving an increasing number of Afghan families to sell their daughters into forced marriages. Girls as young as 6 are being married into a life of slavery and rape, often by multiple members of their new relatives. Banned from seeing their own parents or siblings, they are also prohibited from going to school. With little effective recourse, many of the victims are driven to self-immolation, burning themselves to death or severe self-harm. Civilian casualties in Iraq are now at post-invasion highs, thanks in part to an expanded U.S. air war, a model we now see being applied with greater frequency in Iraq. to give a figure between January and September 2007, that January and September 2007 alone, U.S. and NATO coalition allies dropped 1 million pounds of ordnance on Afghanistan. That's more than double the entire year of 2006, the figure for 2006. To those who argue we broke it, so we must fix it, rather than fixing the two countries, we are only breaking them further. And to those who say we cannot withdraw precipitously, there's nothing precipitous about pulling out after 5 years, or in the case of Afghanistan, 7 years of occupying another country illegally. We have no rights to be in either country in the first place. Senator John McCain said recently, troops may have to stay in Iraq for 100 or 1,000 or even 10,000 years, he said. His position's clear. But I think we have to acknowledge as well that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, the Democratic candidates, also would not end the occupation of Iraq or of Afghanistan. As the Wall Street Journal reported on February 29th, despite the rhetoric of the Democratic presidential candidates, significant numbers of U.S. troops will remain in Iraq regardless of who wins in November.
Okay, I'm going to take that as a chance to let you know what you're listening to. And also, silly me, I was telling you about my website and I forgot to give the address. So if you would like to visit that, it is at www.unbossed, U-N-B-O-S-S-E-D, that kind of unbossed, .livejournal.com. So that is my website. And who you're listening to right now is Anthony Arnov. He's with Iraq Veterans Against the War. This is a conference he gave a couple months back called Winter Soldier, Iraq and Afghanistan, Eyewitness Account of the Occupations. So that's the last time I'm going to talk to you tonight. I hope everyone's well, and we'll see you next week. Okay, take care, everyone.
Indeed, if you look at their actual proposals, Senators Clinton and Obama have said we must keep troops in Iraq for counterterrorism operations, for force protection, and training Iraq soldiers, so-called Iraqification. The journal notes that, quote, conducting such missions would require the sustained development of tens of thousands of American military personnel, foreign policy advisors from both campaigns acknowledge. This is a perfect example of the circular logic of occupation. If there were no U.S. troops and no U.S. military bases in Iraq, and if the United States were not building in Baghdad the largest U.S. embassy or largest embassy of any government in the world in history, and if you didn't have the presence of more than 150,000 U.S. contractors in Iraq, you wouldn't need other troops for force protection. Counterterrorism, of course, is the same rationale that President Bush offers for why troops must stay. And training is the same discredited argument of Bush. As the Iraqis stand up, we will stand down. In addition, Senators Clinton and Obama have both talked about increasing overall U.S. troop levels by tens of thousands and adding more troops to the occupation of Afghanistan, including some of the troops that may potentially be redeployed from Iraq. One top aide to the Obama campaign, interviewed recently by journalist Jeremy Scahill, writing in The Nation magazine, even left open the possibility that if elected president, Obama would rely on greater numbers of mercenaries from companies such as Blackwater, Triple Canopy, and DynCorp in Iraq to replace troops redeployed to other theaters. And it's important to acknowledge that because that means that the work that Iraq Veterans Against War is doing, the work that people are organizing this weekend, is so important and has to continue no matter who is in office in 2009. The reason that the Democrats aren't providing an alternative, the reason that they've continued to fund the war in Congress after saying that they oppose the war, and in many cases being elected on the basis of that position, is that the geopolitical stakes for the United States are so high. Neither party, neither the Republicans or the Democrats, wants to preside over a defeat of the United States in Afghanistan or Iraq, and manage the consequences that would follow. To understand why, we can dispense with all the public relations reasons for these wars. WMD, Al-Qaeda, liberating people living in tyrannical regimes, none of which hold up to scrutiny, and should instead look at the geopolitical interests driving both occupations. And here I want to make five brief points. First, Afghanistan and Iraq were meant to have a demonstration effect, signaling to other states around the world that the U.S. government has the right, which it will on a limited basis extend to allies such as Israel, to engage in preemptive strikes against any country it chooses, that it will defer to the United Nations and other international bodies only when it suits its ends and will dismiss them as irrelevant otherwise, and that it will allow no challenge to the credibility of U.S. imperialism. As one unnamed hawk quoted in the New York Times put it, by setting up our military in Iraq, we can set an example to other countries. We can set an example to other countries. If you cooperate with terrorists or menace us in any way or even look at us cross-eyed, this could happen to you. Second, the invasions were intended to give the United States greater control over the Middle East and Central and Western Asia, home to the vast majority of the world's oil reserves, most of the world's natural gas reserves, and also home to vital pipelines and shipping routes for energy. In the words of former Bush speechwriter David Frum, an American-led overthrow of Saddam Hussein and the replacement of the radical Ba'athist dictatorship with a new government more closely aligned with the United States would put America more wholly in charge of the region than any power since the Ottomans, or maybe even the Romans. That was the objective. The United States' interest in Middle Eastern and Asian energy is not primarily motivated by consumption needs, but motivated by geopolitical advantages that flow from controlling this oil and natural gas. U.S. policy planners understand that the main power centers that could emerge as peer rivals to the United States in the future and that could threaten its status as the world's sole superpower, namely India and China, the combined countries of the European Union, all are more reliant on energy imports from the Middle East than is the United States. Regional hegemony, therefore, gives the United States tremendous leverage and influence vis-a-vis competing economic and military powers that are dependent on these energy resources. As oil gets more expensive to extract, and as exploration is forced to seek out more dangerous geographic and political terrain for new oil finds, control over these energy resources and trade routes has grown more important to U.S. imperial strategy than even before. And it's always been a central axiom of U.S. foreign policy in the past several decades. Third, the plan for a quick and easy victory and regime change in both Afghanistan and Iraq was meant to establish client states in these two strategically located countries and provide the United States with important bases for military personnel and equipment, and also bases for projection of U.S. power, particularly to isolate and engineer regime change, ideally, in nearby Iran and Syria. These regional bases of power were also intended to enhance the ability of the United States to project power globally. That is, Washington hoped to use regional hegemony to preserve and expand its global hegemony, enhance its ability to intervene economically and politically in the affairs of any country around the world where the U.S. has interests, using U.S. military might to bully countries into compliance with its political and its economic program. Of course, this has backfired. Instead of being in a stronger position, the United States is in a weaker position regionally and internationally. But in many ways, this is only further raised the stakes. In particular, Iran has emerged as a more powerful regional player as a result of U.S. actions in both Afghanistan and Iraq. And we see, as a result, greater threats of an attack on Iran, particularly an aerial attack on Iran's nuclear facilities or alleged nuclear facilities, which are also intended to facilitate regime change in that country. Meanwhile, Venezuela and Russia have also started to develop new energy relationships with Iran and other countries to develop independent trade relations and energy supply routes that threaten U.S. control and domination of energy markets. And keep in mind that Venezuela is a leading supplier of oil to the United States, and that Russia has the world's largest supply of natural gas reserves. Fourth, both occupations were linked to a set of economic objectives that extend far beyond the question of the huge subsidies and profits created for political allies in the national security, military, industrial complex, and extend to the much bigger prize of imposing a neoliberal model throughout all the Middle East and Western and Central Asia that would give the United States privileged access to these markets and open them to much greater foreign ownership and control. Fifth, the Bush administration thought that by its invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, it could bury once and for all the so-called Vietnam Syndrome, eliminating the public's reluctance to see Washington intervene militarily in the affairs of other countries and undermining international opposition to U.S. unilateralism. In other words, they wanted to overcome the defeat that the brave veterans from Vietnam and VVAW and the other groups that organized against that war achieved in defeating the United States in Vietnam and the legacy, the very important legacy they created. And that's very important to acknowledge. And that's why they're holding on so tenaciously to the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan to salvage some other outcome, no matter what the human cost. These were the real objectives that drove the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, and that explain why the United States is continuing both occupations, despite all the harm they have caused to the Iraqi people, to the people of Afghanistan, to the people of the region, and to the U.S. troops being asked to wage these unjust and illegal wars. The truth is, the architects of both occupations have contempt for the people of Iraq and Afghanistan that they claim to have liberated, and they have contempt for the very troops they claim so loudly to support. The best way we can support the troops in reality is to bring them home now, not in 16 months or in 16 years, and to provide them the social, economic, medical, and psychological assistance that they need and deserve. Genuine support, not bumper sticker slogans and empty rhetoric. And the best way we can support the people of Afghanistan and Iraq is to withdraw from their countries immediately and unconditionally and pay reparations for the enormous harm and destruction that we have caused, opening the possibility for the genuine humanitarian assistance, reconstruction, and self-determination these countries desperately need. We cannot count on our elected or unelected officials to realize their folly and end the occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan and the imperial project of which they are a component part. Only pressure of a movement that centrally includes soldiers, veterans, and their families, can bring that about. The stakes really could not be higher for the people of Iraq, for the people of Afghanistan, for the people of this country, or really for the people of the world. Thank you.